morning, ladies and gentlemen. Can you pay attention, please? Good morning. I welcome you all to this session, which is jointly organized by the Global Health Workforce Alliance, UNAIDS, and the National AIDS Society, the session which deals with HIV and human resources, competing priorities or interconnecting solutions. My name is Dr. Mubashir Sheikh. I'm the Executive Director of the Global Health Workforce Alliance, an alliance which is a convener or an advocate which brings different stakeholders and constituencies together to discuss and deliberate and address the issues related to the global shortage of health workforce in its broader terms within the functioning health system. I'm delighted and honored that I'll be joined by Dr. Sir George Elhane to co-chair this session, who is the United Nations Secretary General's Special Envoy on HIV/AIDS since 2003. He has a long and distinguished career in PAHO, which is the Pan-American Health Organization, including as its head from 1995 to 2003. He was knighted by the Queen Elizabeth II in 1990 for his services in medicines. Maybe I will ask George if you want to say a few words to welcome the participants as well.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I was just joined in welcoming you to this session. It is not really arrogance on my part to suggest that we'll be dealing with one of the most important issues in terms of the AIDS response. I look forward to hearing from you and to making a small contribution, and I'll turn you back over to Sheikh, Dr. Sheikh, for continuation and to tell you what you're supposed to do during the course of these next 2 hours. Welcome.
We are also grateful that we are joined by an esteemed panel of speakers. We have among us on the stage, Dr. Peter Piot, who is the Executive Director of UNAIDS. We have Daisy Nefabelo, who is the Assistant Director General, Family and Community Health, World Health Organization. We have Craig McClure, Executive Director of the International AIDS Society. And we have Sigrun Mogadil, who is HIV/AIDS Ambassador for the Norway and Chair of the Global Health Workforce Alliance. These distinguished speakers will take a few minutes to brief you on their thoughts and on their vision in terms of the objectives and the theme of this particular session, and I'm sure we'll greatly benefit from their contribution this morning. Obviously, I'm sure all of you will understand that we have a busy schedule here, so some of the speakers may not be able to stay with us for the whole duration of the session, but it's great that, and we are really grateful that they have joined us. And we also have with us Dr. Jim Yong King, who will be the moderating the entire session subsequent to the presentations by the speakers. Ladies and gentlemen, this session is basing a critical issue which goes directly to the heart of the theme of this particular conference, which is the universal access to HIV/AIDS prevention, treatment, care, and support. But we also know that there is a situation where we are facing a global shortage of health workforce. We know that there is a shortage of millions of health workers, more than 4 million, which is truly a global problem. But we also know that the greater problem is in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, and in the developing world. But we also know that this issue is absolutely critical to overcome the shortage of health workers if we want to address this issue of universal access to HIV, AIDS treatment, care, and support. And that's why we thought this session will help us crystallize, understands, and underlines some of the key issues which emphasizes the interconnectivity and the linkage and the synergies between the two issues. And we do hope that the speakers' presentations, as well as during the panel discussions, we will have the opportunity to learn a few more good practices, some of the issues, some of the challenges which we're facing in this particular area. But we'll also we'll be able to have some kind of understanding that how do we want to move forward. Some of the key areas where we can learn more, but where we can use this learned experience to move forward in addressing this global challenge, in both in terms of shortage of health workers as well as in terms of HIV/AIDS. Just to give you a brief introduction why we are here, many of you might have joined us in the Kampala in March 2008, where we had the first global forum on health workers. And there, Dr. Peter Piot, who's sitting here, challenged us to take this agenda because HIV/AIDS came forward very strong, in strong terms, during the debate there. So he suggested that we should take this debate forward to Mexico. And I'm glad that we could manage, and we are here to discuss exactly that particular issue. What I just I wouldn't spend too much time on the technical side of the discussion. You have seen the objectives, and I'm sure as we move along, it will become more clear. But I would spend, because we are short of time and we have to finish within the next 2 hours, I will just follow and we make a brief introduction of the process which will follow in the next an hour or so. The session is designed in a way that we will have these four distinguished speakers. Each one will be requested to make a presentation of not more than 5 minutes, bringing different perspective of different constituencies. And then we will request Jim to start moderating the panel discussions, where we have a very distinguished group of people, where we have two sides. One is basically representing the human health systems and implementers group, and others, which are people and constituencies living and dealing with issues related to HIV/AIDS. We hope that the two panels will be able to interact with each other on two specific themes. The first part of the panel discussion will look at the linkages between the health systems and in specific terms to shortage of health workers and HIV/AIDS. The two different maybe tracks, but how do we need to come together, to work together, to achieve the common objective of accessing, ensuring universal access to HIV/AIDS in its specific terms, but also in the broader context of health system functional and in terms of MDGs and other related obligations. But then the second half of the panel discussion will look into the area of stigma in terms of discrimination which are being faced by the people living with HIV, but also the health workers, from their peers and from the society at large. So these two discussions will follow one after the other, and we'll be spending almost equal time on these discussions and requesting the panelists to share their thoughts and to raise issues. But then this will be followed by an interaction with the audience. All of you are sitting here, so we'll have about half an hour for that interaction. But to make that interaction more meaningful, we're requesting that you please start writing your questions or queries and sharing with us. There will be people around from the secretariat who will go around and collect these questions. So please raise those questions, write down with a piece of paper which has been provided to all of you, and then we'll collect them. And obviously you will understand that it will not be possible for us to respond to all the questions, but we'll try our best. Jim, I'm sure, will make an effort to respond to as many questions as possible with the help of the panelists. But just to ensure you that even if we are not able to answer all the questions, we will be able to include them in our report, and also maybe we can follow up with some of the discussion later on. Now, very quickly, without any further ado, let me start inviting the speakers. Our first speaker is Dr. Peter Piot, who is the head of who's executive director of the United UNAIDS. And he's in this position since the creation of this body in 1995. And is also serving as the Undersecretary General of the United Nations. Drawing on his skills as a scientist, manager, and activist, Dr. Piot has challenged world leaders to view AIDS in the context of social and economic development as well as security. Under his leadership, UNAIDS has become the chief advocate for worldwide action against AIDS. So, Peter, could you please come? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mubashir, and thank you for your leadership and for following up on what we indeed discussed at the Workforce Alliance meeting in Kampala, together with Sigrun Mogudal. So that's it's really great tweet, because you can say it's normal to follow up on what we agree, but unfortunately in the real world that doesn't always happen like that. And I'm very pleased with to be on the podium with my good friends, all the panelists. I went to the meeting in Kampala because I'm looking at where we are in the response to AIDS. It's very clear that when you take a long-term perspective, there is no way that we, A, can expand access to treatment, and two, that we can sustain what has been achieved without some serious investments in the health workforce. And the meeting in Kampala was not always easy, because it's clear that we operate sometimes on different planets, those who are working on health systems, healthcare workers, and those dealing with AIDS, but it's time to come together. And so it's the first time that I'm aware of that the International AIDS Conference is really addressing this issue, and it's long overdue, and I'm really happy with that, and would like to thank the International AIDS Society for that. We are definitely entering into a new stage in the response to AIDS in many, many countries, with fewer people dying and fewer people becoming infected, although the AIDS epidemic is not over anywhere in the world, and it's going to be with us for many years. And on the one hand, you can say 3 million people on antiretroviral therapy in low and middle income countries. That's quite an achievement. On the other hand, there is the number of people who do not have access, 6 million who are in need and do not have access. So we still have a long way to go, but it's the first time that a chronic treatment program is being implemented in poor resource environments. And in many cases, this achievement has come despite the fact that health systems are not really functioning, not because of them. And it has really happened because there has been a movement. People have come together to demand treatment and to find ways to provide it. But it's really important to keep this achievement in perspective. AIDS is far from over yet. And I think that it's the combination of the need for sustainability of the achievements to the need to expand treatment to those who have not had access to it yet, because the low-hanging fruit may be over. And thirdly, that our understanding now that AIDS is really a long-wave phenomenon. And so we need to work on the structural and systematic and systemic issues that will guarantee a solid and sustainable response. So, and we will need to keep up our efforts for decades to come. That's not very cheerful news, particularly not for the on the economic side, but that's the fact. AIDS is often cited as a revealer of problems, and I think the health worker issue is a case in point. HIV does not spare health workers to start with. We'll hear about that, but there are countries where there has been a real hemorrhage in terms of healthcare workers because of the AIDS epidemic. No diploma protects you from acquiring HIV. The problem is not new. It has been neglected for years, saying that it's the AIDS efforts that would undermine the health system and healthcare workers is, to say the least, not supported by any facts, and people with even a memory of 15 years would know better. But I think that the AIDS epidemic now, where we are at this stage, offers a major opportunity to jumpstart long overdue action. And in a number of countries, HIV programs may be one of the only sources of funding available to address the workforce crisis. And there are good examples. I'm sure that Jim will speak about also what's going on in Rwanda, for example. We see what is going on in Malawi, in Ethiopia, where in a very pragmatic way, one has been using the opportunity of the tragedy of AIDS to strengthen the workforce and to come up with innovative solutions. And before ending, let me say that I think that there are a number of lessons or practices of the, from the AIDS movement that could be very useful also for becoming really serious about the health workforce issue. One is to set ambitious targets. You need to know what you're fighting for. Two is don't move without full involvement of civil society, of the people who are most concerned. In our case, people living with HIV, vulnerable groups, but that could also be true for, healthcare force working. Have a rights-based approach. not being intimidated by the fact, oh, there is no money. No, you said this is what is needed, and then work towards that, and working across sectors. The good news is that things start moving, that we're coming to better, and really it's thanks to the coalition that the issue is now being tackled in a more systematic way, and also because I think we in the AIDS movement, we are reaching the limits of our ability to expand our efforts, particularly in the treatment and care area, and that's an objective reason, to use that term, why we should work together. So thank you for putting it together. You can count on me and on UNAIDS. We will not be a central player on this, but we will make sure that we will join forces to resolve this health worker crisis, which will illustrate again that, you know, with AIDS we have not only a revealer of injustice and fault lines, but also a major opportunity to build a better world. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter, for your sustained leadership, commitment, and assurance that this issue stays high on the political agenda, and we continue working together with all the challenges and the problems we are still facing in this critical area of health systems. Now, let me request Daisy Mefebulu, who is the Assistant Director General of Family and Community Health of the World Health Organization. She has started her career in public health almost 26 years ago as a nurse and a midwife. She has held several positions in senior management within the South African public health sector, including Director of Human Resources and later as the Deputy Director General of Health. Daisy, can I request you to please share your thoughts? Thank you.
Coaches, distinguished ladies and gentlemen, it's really my pleasure to be here and participating on this important topic. A topic which is very close to my heart, and some of those people that I've worked with in various fora would know that the issue of human resources is very, very dear to my heart, and therefore it's my pleasure to participate in this session. And I believe the topic that we are looking at right now, it's one topic which, in my view, is long overdue. The discussion of this topic, which very few people would even venture to talk about, is quite critical. So I'm happy that the organizers did really fit it into the discussions during the course of this AIDS conference. I would therefore like to share with you my thoughts on the question that we're talking about, on human resources and HIV and AIDS. To me, human resources constraints exemplify and amplify the tensions that we have between HIV and health systems. And yet the two are so inextricably linked together. There's no way that you can address, in my view, one in the isolation of the other. We are currently only less than 2 years away from the target date of achieving universal access to treatment, care, and support. And this ambitious goal, in my view, cannot be achieved unless we address one fundamental obstacle, and that fundamental obstacle is human resources. So there's no way that we can really say, in the absence of adequate human resources, we'll be able to achieve universal access to HIV prevention, treatment, and care. There is, in my view, no uncertainty that HIV and AIDS increases the burden of disease, and I'm sure that in your minds as well, you have certainty about that it increases the burden of disease. But what does that mean? It means that then the workload increases for the health workforce. But it's also a very well-known fact that in many countries, especially the ones that are hard hit by HIV and AIDS, these countries have lost high percentages of their workforces due to AIDS. So that is an additional problem onto the problem that we are facing. And the few that are remaining are also experiencing psychological stresses due to the not only the heavy workload that they have to be working with, but also just the stress of knowing that you are dealing with people that might be at the end of their lives, or you are only providing palliative care, or the mere fact of knowing that it is possible that you can save someone's lives, but you don't have the means at your disposal to do that. That creates a burden for most of our health workers. And all these things are happening against the backdrop of international migration of health workers. And unfortunately, this migration is happening from the countries that are hard hit by AIDS. The interconnectedness, as I've outlined, between HIV and AIDS and human resources underscores, therefore, the need for AIDS and health systems movements to work together. I think the two movements have to work together. There's no option but to work together if we really need to see progress. To provide a synopsis of health workforce crisis, we need to work together to highlight the HIV impacts on the health workers. We need to work together to clarify why human resources for health as part of a functioning health systems are fundamental for scaling up, and as I've mentioned on earlier on, why they are so fundamental in achieving universal access. And not only achieving universal access to HIV treatment, prevention, care and support, but also to achieving the Millennium Development Goals. I think we need to work together as well to review ways to ensure that a motivated workforce is there to contribute to increased utilization of services. Not only that, but making sure that they don't just add to the stigma and discrimination of people living with HIV and AIDS and those that are infected. Most importantly, I think it's important for the AIDS and the health system movements to work together to find interconnected solutions for the interconnected priorities. So as WHO, we are really committed to finding ways of how we could work with all these people and all the role players to make sure that we can really find these interconnected solutions to the two interconnected priorities. Thank you.
Thank you, Daisy. Your presence is absolutely critical and important because we know that WHO has a critical role and important role to play, and your presence here and reiteration of the commitment on behalf of WHO for continuous leadership and taking action to address these two interconnected issues is very important, and we really appreciate that you have been here and took the time to join us. Now I would request Craig McClure, who is the Executive Director of the International AIDS Society. Craig has been working in the field of HIV/AIDS for the last 15 years, primarily in the areas of policy, advocacy, and education. He has played a central role in the development of the 3x5 strategy, and I'm glad that he has joined all of us here and also co-sponsoring this session. Craig.
Thanks very much. This is working. Thank you very much. I think we need more energy in this room to compete with the energy and enthusiasm of the room behind us. And certainly there's no issue in HIV that should stimulate energy than the issue of health system strengthening broadly and the health workforce crisis specifically. The International AIDS Society is a global association of HIV professionals with about 12,000 members in 185 countries, working at all levels of the response, as physicians and other healthcare professionals and public health and policy experts and community practitioners. So the global health workforce crisis and the broader challenge of strengthening health systems are issues that are faced by most, if not all, of our members on a daily basis. We put out a request to our membership for input on this debate, and we received a range of specific concerns facing HIV professionals in the field. including but not limited to the challenge of HIV infection amongst health workers themselves, the stigma and discrimination felt by them, including stigma and discrimination within the healthcare system, the challenge of broadening the engagement of community members in provision of HIV prevention, treatment, and care, integration of HIV and other health services, including primary care, pre- and postnatal care, maternal health, sexual and reproductive health, as well as treatment of TB and other co-infections, and also the challenge of training and retaining health workers, and specifically the loss of health workers in developing countries from the public sector to NGOs and faith-based organizations due to higher wages and better conditions, and the need to integrate or at least regulate the quality of services provided by a range of different providers across a country. A number of different analyses and reports, of course, have been conducted recently examining these challenges and their impact on overall health systems and suggesting ways forward. Just to mention a couple, the International Treatment Preparedness Coalition's report, Missing the Target 6, launched on the 29th of July, highlighted several positive effects of HIV scale-up, including relieving demand for hospital beds, emergency room services, motivating and expanding the capacity of healthcare workers. However, the report also found that HIV scale-up had revealed fragilities in the health systems and created new challenges. This report reminds us that building interconnected solutions between HIV and human resources will be necessary for achievement of universal access goals and health-related Millennium Development Goals, and will also be dependent on evidence-informed policies and interventions. Just to mention one other report, the 2008 WHO and UNAIDS Progress Report on Scaling Up Interventions in HIV in the Health Sector towards Universal Access shows that the increase in the number of healthcare workers receiving antiretroviral therapy has not only saved lives and stemmed losses due to AIDS, but also reduced absenteeism and gained the health system thousands of health worker days. In addition, HIV programs are contributing to alleviating the health workforce crisis through task shifting models. However, we still face the challenge of not having enough systematic evidence to inform the development of effective policies based on what is happening on the ground. In addition, there is a general lack of systematic study beyond the documentation of strong case studies on how HIV interventions may be contributing to health systems capacity. So what is IAS' contribution to bringing the AIDS and health agendas closer together, including human resources as a bridge? At the IAS pathogenesis meeting last year in Sydney, we launched what was called the Sydney Declaration, calling for an expansion of research more broadly and specifically operations research in order to enhance essential research systems and generate strategic information needed for optimizing HIV interventions and improving the effectiveness of already stretched health systems, including the expansion and the sustainability of the health workforce. This declaration was signed by over 5,000 people and contributed to enhancing efforts and collaboration amongst partners, including WHO, the Global Fund, the World Bank, UNAIDS, and the IAS, to push for an initiative on addressing knowledge gaps in the public health approach to delivering antiretroviral therapy and care. And you'll be hearing a lot more about this during the conference. We also committed in 2007 to making health systems strengthening broadly and the health workforce crisis specifically issues of permanent issues at the International AIDS Conference. And as Peter mentioned, this may be one of the first sessions on the issue, but there are a number of issues at this conference exploring the challenges from a number of different angles. To contribute to building a strong body of evidence, IAS is also participating in a World Bank-led study in collaboration with WHO, the Fund, and UNAIDS, entitled Health Systems and HIV, a review and analysis of the impact of international AIDS funding on the building blocks of country health systems and recommendations for an effective and equitable global response. And for the next pathogenesis conference in Cape Town next year, operations research has been added as a fourth track to the conference. And really, the purpose of that is to really drive more research in this area to better understand how rollout of HIV services is impacting health systems so that we can better impact in a positive way health systems in the future. And then finally, as a founding member of the Global Health Workforce Alliance, we're working in partnership to expand attention to this issue and to try to find focused solutions to the problem. You know, just in conclusion, the HIV movement has changed healthcare across all regions of the world, and even more dramatically in resource-limited settings. The movement has created millions of empowered individuals involved in the management of their own health, literate in highly technical aspects of their own treatment, demanding services, helping to plan and design programs, demanding additional resources, and challenging governments towards greater transparency and accountability. The greater involvement of people living with HIV and the communities most affected by HIV provides us with a range of lessons to build on in supporting communities to raise awareness and claim their right for equal access to quality health services overall. Their engagement and their primary role in mobilizing societies is central to expanding human resources and strengthening health systems through the AIDS response. I want to stop there because I think the important thing is to have an interactive discussion about this. I just need to say that as the conference is opening tonight, I have a billion things to do, and my colleague Jacqueline Bataringaya, who is the policy and advocacy coordinator at the IIS, who's really doing the bulk of the work on this issue, will replace me in this seat in a few minutes as I'll need to move on. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Craig, and thanks. We understand that you have too many things and too many commitments, but thanks for informing us about the initiatives and various activities being undertaken through IAS, and also emphasizing that despite considerable developments, we still have serious challenges and serious issues to address, and thanks for raising those issues. Let me move on to Sigrun Mogdal, who is the chair of the board of the Global Health Workforce Alliance, and she has been the Norwegian HIV-AIDS ambassador since 2005. She is currently a board member of the Global Funds to Fight Against AIDS, TB, and Malaria, the board on Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, as well as the board on UNITAID. From 2000 to 2001, she was also the state secretary of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs for International Development. Sigrun.
Thank you, great to be here. I don't mind that Peter is going. We were together in Kampala. I can just echo his voice. We made this promise together. And among the competing voices that's here, we are also happy that we're able to bring together the agenda around human resource and action on AIDS.
Yes.
Thanks, Peter.
We're comrades together. And it's a movement. I think we have actually a lot to be accountable for, and I've been thinking about that before this conference. It took us a long time to respond to HIV/AIDS. There was no need for that epidemic to grow before the world started to recognize. It's taken us a long time to be aware of what's happening on human resource. It's as if that has been on the sideline, recurrent expenditure, things that we just needed to know were there. It wasn't a focus for how we needed to move forward. So we have a lot to be accountable for. But there is a movement now, I think, and I'm happy to be here representing the board of the Global Workforce Alliance together with a number of other board members that are here, Miriam, Suit, I think, is here.
Eric.
And some of them, Eric is here, that have carried this concern from something hardly anybody were really concerned about to now starting of a movement. Let me just also say that as we talk about competing priorities, let's acknowledge that it's not easy to solve competing priorities. The world is full of competing priorities. Daily life of a politician is full of competing priorities. National, I know Tedros would say the same, sitting as a health minister in Ethiopia. So we're not here to sort of say there will be no more competing priorities, there will be no more competing voices. We're in the middle of voices and priorities. So the issue we're talking about is how can we make sense of a situation where we have to do many things at the same time and interconnect and make choices and make them explicit and make them together and make them in accountability to each other. That's what this is about, and that's also why the alliance needs to go beyond the usual suspects. It needs to go beyond WHO. It needs to go beyond donors or national governments, because in order to deal with this issue, we have to work with professional associations, we have to work with private sector, we have to work with movements, NGOs, clinical trials, research, what have you. There is a global shortage, and we're all competing to get workers to create results and to show that we can move forward. That's what the Global Health Workforce Alliance is all about, to try to convene all these actors and try to make sense of all the things we need to think about so that each priority is heard, so that each country and each locality can actually deal with the complexities of these issues. There is no global prescription. Linking up is the only answer, as we've just heard, and I could be just saying amen. I just came from a faith session on faith, so I could have said here amen to all my colleagues. Let me just say, within all these competing priorities, there are also issues that is very hard to solve. We heard some of them around stigma. Definitely, when you have a small pool of health workers, salary issues, how do you behave in markets, ethical recruitment across borders, but also huge privatization, what about the public and the private? We have the question, for instance, on volunteers. So nobody has mentioned that yet. Should they be paid? Should they not be paid? Numerous of those questions that we somehow have to face up to and try to find solutions to together. And I don't need to say anything more to this issue now, because it will come. But closing, we cannot wait until all these things are fixed. And that's also part of reality. We have to live with the complexity. We have to take a step at a time, and we have to do it together, and doing it in such a way that we want to make sure that we don't harm the other party. Because as we struggle together, as there are several streams of action side by side in a country or in a locality by different partners, let's at least find a platform where we convene the actors and are accountable to each other. And I think that's also what this needs to be about. So thank you.
Thanks, Sigrun. Thanks for highlighting again the complexity of the issues and the factors, but also emphasizing that it's an issue which needs involvement of everyone. It's everyone's business, and it is everyone's contribution. So we hope that our discussion will sort of take this, some of the points, some of the challenges which have been raised by the speakers. You know, Jim and the panelists, I'm sure, will be able to, with the participation of the audience here, to discuss and raise these issues in a little more, deliberate them in more detail. And as I said earlier, we may be able to find some agreement or some better understanding of what exactly needs to be done in concrete terms. But thanks, everyone, to all the speakers once again. Before I pass on to Jim to start the panel discussion and invite the panelists, I just want to say a couple of things. One is that please start, I requested all of you to, if possible, to wherever you are interested, to raise questions and issues. So please raise your hands if you have a question, and someone will be there to collect this, the questions. I would also like to emphasize that Sir George Elain, my co-chair at the end, would have the difficult task to sum up and to share with us what exactly, hopefully, we will be able to agree during the course of the next hour and so. Jim, I request you to move to the panel discussion, but just to let you know that Jim, as I'm sure most of you know, has been has a 20 years experience in improving health in developing countries. He's a co-founder of Partners in Health, a non-profit organization that supports a range of health programs in poor communities worldwide. In 2004 and 5, Dr. Kim served as the director of World Health Organization on HIV/AIDS department, including leading the 3x5 initiative. He is currently leading a new Harvard University-based initiative in global health delivery, which is designed to discover and widely share knowledge about the effective implementation of health programs in poor communities. So, Jim, please help us move forward. And I also want to welcome and once again thank the distinguished panelists who have joined us for this discussion. Thank you very much once again.
Thank you very much, everybody. Can we turn the mics up just a little bit? Is that possible? That'd be great. Thank you. I go to two sets of meetings, the HIV meetings and the tuberculosis meetings. And at the tuberculosis meetings, we never have to compete with singing. But it's kind of a good thing. And if we just speak in rhythm with singing, we'll be fine. We're really thrilled to have a fantastic panel here. Sigrun Mogadal, you met. We also have Anandi Yuvaraj from the Asia-Pacific region representing the community of people living with HIV. We have Greg Gonsalves from the AIDS Rights Alliance for Southern Africa. And we have Jacqueline Bataringaya from the International AIDS Society. We also have the Honorable Minister Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Minister of Health of Ethiopia. We have Tesfa Ghebreyesus, representing the World Health Professions Alliance. We have Pat Doust from the Health Workforce Advocacy Initiative, and Julio Frank from the Grupo Carso Health Initiative, but also soon to be Dean of Harvard School of Public Health, and soon to be my boss. So I want to start by giving a sense for how this debate has evolved. And the debate has evolved in sometimes very intense and even angry terms. Let me read you some positions that have been taken. And these are positions that have now come out in writing. Roger England writes, throwing money at countries through disease-specific global programs might make good press, but it is not the way to help Africa. Money for combating HIV/AIDS is the worst. This now exceeds the whole health budget of many of the recipient countries, such as Uganda. It distorts countries' efforts to deal with their problems because most of this new aid is delivered off budget, resulting in separate plans, operations, and monitoring, all in parallel with government systems. Our friend Stuart Tyson from the British Department for International Development has written, or has said, in talking about Zambia, has said that they have, and this is the Zambians, they have to get so many people on treatment by the end of year two, year three, year four. How do they do it? They put an advertisement in the paper in Lusaka and they hire 400 health workers. Where do they take them from? They move them from one part of the health system where they are delivering children and providing general health services, looking after kids, to work just on AIDS. This is a no-win, no-win situation. It is robbing Peter to pay Paul. On the other hand, Wafael Sadr and Elaine Abrams from Columbia University have written that we postulate, however, that if the resources available for scale-up of HIV care was utilized for the design and implementation of HIV programs with attention to benefiting the broader health services, this effort may catalyze the transformation of health services into more effective and responsive ones that are capable of addressing the health needs of all individuals in these communities. Lincoln Chen, my colleague from Harvard, who really started with the Joint Learning Initiative on Human Resources for Health, this increased attention to human resources, has written, priority disease control programs usually deploy workers through vertically integrated systems with strong support and supervision. In many situations, this deployment can improve health systems, producing new energy, more resources, motivated workers, better information, and higher demand among clients. So, for our panel, and let me start with Honorable Minister Tedros from Ethiopia, you face these challenges, these trade-offs, these difficulties every single day. Can you tell us, from your perspective, how you deal with these kinds of situations?
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for giving me this chance to participate in this very important discussion. Yes, I have to admit that because of, you know, vertical or specific programs, you know, the other health programs are being affected, like, for instance, moving some people from the general to the specific. But I think we need to understand what are the root causes for this. I don't think it's because the money which is coming from PEPFAR or Global Fund is actually the root cause of this problem. The root cause of this problem is there is underinvestment in training, actually, our workforce or in producing. So when this problem had happened, actually, what we tried to do is we tried to assess our internal situation. We tried to understand the root cause of the problem. And what we found out was that there was a shortage of health professionals, and this is because we don't produce enough. So it's because there was a short supply, and that's why we were competing. So we did two things. One, when we talk about human resources, we shouldn't lump sum it. It's not just one problem, and the solution cannot be one. For instance, for HIV/AIDS, the major strategy is prevention. And for prevention, it's, I think, primary health care, which is the major vehicle. And the human resources required for primary health care is, you know, low-level and mid-level health professionals. And to complain about mid-level and low-level health professionals is, I think, wrong. If there is any problem, it should be the problem of the country, because the mid- and low-level health professionals are not affected by brain drain. So for any country, using the opportunity which is coming, we need to really produce enough cadre for the primary health care, because most of the things, be it preventive or curative, can be done actually at the primary health care level. So that's how we tried to address the problem. We tried to identify the human resources we need based on the programs we have, based on the priorities we have, and we tried to train enough of that, which is not really a problem in terms of brain drain. For instance, in Ethiopia, for the primary health care, we identified a cadre of health extension workers, full-time paid, and we have targeted to train 30,000, and we have trained and deployed 24,000. And the remaining 6,000 will be trained by December 2008. So this cadre will work on the prevention, prevention not only for HIV, actually, for other programs as well. And we use the HIV money, the malaria money from PEPFAR and Global Fund to use this cadre of health professionals, and they're actually serving their communities. And when you go higher, training nurses and health officers is also going well in Ethiopia. And this will cover the first curative services. And more than 90% of our patients actually need the attention of health officers and nurses. They don't need really highly skilled professionals. So that's why I say, when we complain about human resources, when we lump sum it like 4 million, I don't accept it, because they're not just, we're not talking about one category of health professionals. And we have, based on the need, based on the level of services we give, we need different categories of health professionals. And if we're going to complain about health professionals, we can complain about the highly skilled, but the remaining can be handled by the country. And of course, whatever is coming for vertical programs can be used horizontally. So I don't think it's a good idea to undermine what's being provided by PEPFAR and Global Fund as something for the press, because I'm a witness, and it's making a huge difference in Ethiopia in terms of addressing actually the human resources. So we can train enough mid-level, we can train enough low-level, we can train enough even up to GPs. We have increased our enrollment rate in order to address it. And we may have a problem with highly skilled ones, which are not actually, in terms of, you know, providing services to the majority, don't have actually a huge impact. So we need to categorize it. So in summary, what I would like to say is, it's, you know, whether you keep the balance or not. How can you keep the balance? When you have the funding, how can you use that as an opportunity to address it in the general health? Not only for human resources. For instance, the money we're getting from PEPFAR and Global Fund and the World Bank, we're using it to build our health centers. Because when we talk about universal access, you talk about geographic access, you talk about actually the temporal dimension, the time, you talk about affordability, of course treatment is free, you talk about cultural and social issues, the stigma and so on, and you cannot actually do any specific program activities without the health systems, because the geographic access, the temporal dimension, can only be addressed using the health systems. That's the only way you can address them. And that's why we say we don't actually take them at the separate, you know, the disease-specific and, you know, the health systems, they're one and the same, and one can feed the other one, and one cannot exist without the other one, because we only put disease-specific programs just to show that they're our priorities, because they are the major killers, because they are the majority contributors to morbidity and mortality. The only thing is we need to really balance it, but we cannot work without priorities, we cannot work without focus, and that's why we have disease programs, and then we horizontally link it by strengthening also our health systems. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Professor, thank you. Dr. Julio Frank, Dr. Frank, you have done some of the seminal work in conceptualizing health systems, and many people would think of you as a health systems person. You've certainly been a leader, a thought leader in that area. But you've also talked a lot about getting away from discussions of horizontal and vertical and thinking about the diagonal. What does that mean?
Well, first of all, also as the Mexican on this panel, I want to extend everyone a very warm welcome to my country. I had the privilege of working very closely a few years ago with the IIS to secure the honor for Mexico of hosting the International AIDS Conference. And it's really a great thrill for all of us to see this moment come. So welcome to Mexico. I hope you enjoy your week here and that this conference is as big as a success as we all expect it to be. On the particular subject of this satellite session, I think we need to rephrase and reframe the question, because it's not an issue of AIDS against health systems. Any priority operates through a health system. Even a fragmented health system that, you know, would be completely skewed would be in itself a health system. So it's not that there's something apart from health system that we call treatment and prevention and care for HIV/AIDS. All of those activities always operate through a health system. This debate that was exemplified in the quotes that Jim started with is a very old debate between the idea of having explicit priorities, which we tend to call the vertical approach, and then the strategy called the horizontal strategy of strengthening the health system in general, but without explicit priorities. I don't think that's the solution either, because health systems that don't specify priorities invariably end up catering to the needs of the better off. And those are health systems that end up overinvesting in tertiary hospitals in the urban areas and not taking care of the problems that affect most of the people. And this is why my colleague Jaime Sepúlveda coined this idea, extending the metaphor, the geometric metaphor, that it's neither of those two approaches is good, neither the purely vertical that looks at one priority at a time, nor the strictly horizontal that looks to strengthen the health system without a clear sense of priority, but that we should move to a diagonal strategy. And the diagonal thinking means that you use explicit priorities according to the realities of a country to drive, to be the driver, the trailblazer for generic improvements in the health system that then spill over to the care of other health requirements. And I think Sigrun framed it very well. The problem is not health systems versus aid. The problem is, what is the mix, the appropriate mix of priorities in a country and the degree of integration between those multiple priorities into a unified, integrated health system? That's the real issue. Let me just tell you that this is a possibility. There's countless examples of health systems that have achieved such integration. I can give you the example of my own country. During my 6 years as Minister of Health here, we realized that the main challenge, very much like Minister Tedros is saying, was the insufficient investment in overall infrastructure and the workforce. We decided that many people were paying out-of-pocket catastrophic expenditures, and that was a major barrier. So the big push here, the big policy shift, was to introduce universal health insurance. Now, that was a generic structural transformation of the health system. But when it came to selecting those deliverables that people could relate to the abstract notion of health insurance, the first priority that came out was HIV/AIDS. And the first priority that was selected for what we call accelerated universal coverage was HIV/AIDS. A, because of the burden it represented in Mexico. B, because with the appearance of antiretrovirals, that's where we were witnessing huge financial barriers. And C, because it gave us the political example to relate abstract notions of insurance and investment to a concrete deliverable, so we could garner political support from civil society, from the Congress, the legislature, to actually pass that piece of reform. And today, this happened in 2003, there's 22 million people enrolled in this insurance program. The overall budget for HIV/AIDS grew 14 times, 14 as part of this major drive through universal insurance. And it wouldn't have happened if we didn't have the trailblazer condition that AIDS represented, but it generated a structural reform that is now transforming the health system in a general form for everything else. This, I think, is the essence of the diagonal strategy, and I think this is the solution out of this false dilemma in which we really must avoid falling.
Thank you, Julio. Let me ask Greg Gonsalves. Greg, you know, some of these statements, these are the written ones, but the ones you hear off the side is that people like you, especially you, Greg, specifically, have been too successful. That by advocating so strongly for HIV/AIDS, even if we can make those compromises, that AIDS is just too big. There's too much money going in, and we shouldn't make decisions based on the loud voices of a few troublemakers like you. What do you say to that?
I don't know what to say to that. I mean, I do think the debate is artificial, and the Honorable Minister and ex-ministers, I think, I've got it. I don't feel like we should be on separate sides of this debate. But I do think Roger England and Stuart Tyson are raising issues for a reason. I don't think it's about AIDS versus health systems. I think it's a red herring. I think it's the difference between selective primary care and comprehensive primary care, about achieving the goals from Alma Ata of health for all, or going back to the 70s and 80s, where health systems stagnated under chronic underinvestment and structural adjustment policies that really destroyed health systems. And so I think Stuart and I think Roger are basically saying, you know what, it's AIDS' fault. They don't say it's the donor countries for not investing properly in overseas development aid, including health. They don't say it's the, they blame the AIDS activists, but yet none of them spoke up when structural adjustment policies destroyed public sectors all over the world, not just in HIV, not just in health, but in education and other social services. So I think Roger and Stuart represent a return to the past. It's a return of the press. These are a return of the repressed. These were the people who were against treatment in 2000. You know, I get care in a public clinic outside of Cape Town in a township. It's a public hospital. primary care is given there. I get my care in the context of general medical care. I know that for me and for the millions of people on treatment, the success for treatment, for the 3 million you're on it now and the ability to extend it, is to build comprehensive primary care. Because I'm going to live, hopefully, to a ripe old age to get diabetes and get other health conditions that are going to have to be managed just like my chronic illness is with HIV. And so I don't see any choice for us to do that. But we need to make hold the feet to the fire of donor countries to say you need to invest in health and other social services that need to be done. You have to use activists like me and Anandi and others to drive demand from the ground up for health services and accountability at the national level. You know, a lot of the DFID talk right now is about the international health plan where governments talk to governments again and civil society is left off the table. You know, that's a way to close the doors and make decisions in back rooms. And one of the things we've done in AIDS is been able to hold people's feet to the fire to provide accountability and transparency from a local, national, and regional and international level. And we want to take that forward with health systems and primary health care. So let's not let Roger and Stuart get us off track. I think we have a partnership to build here. We're going to do it. I think a lot of the stuff that's going to come out of this conference is going to talk about how we build that movement together. And we are all partners in this. And you know what? If that's what they want to call me, they can call me any name they want, but we're going to keep moving forward.
Thank you. Let me go right to Anandi. Anandi, what does the health workforce crisis look like from India? And what would you say in the midst of this debate, these claims that we've heard going back and forth? What's been your perspective?
From India perspective, like where I kind of come from, the epidemic is concentrated. And we don't see or come across or have this kind of debate of healthcare work crisis, in terms of the HIV. But we often come across the issue of stigma is the major issue that our healthcare system, where people living with HIV are accessing, are confronting with, and that's the most challenging, for our part of the world. Stigma is the major issue.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that in just a second. Let me turn to Pat. Pat, you're part of an advocacy initiative for the health workforce. How do you see the debate as it's taking shape?
Well, like some have said already, I don't really think this is a debate per se here in this room. I think it's time to have a really worthwhile, effective discussion of how we can draw our common knowledge and our common ground together. As Peter said, I think AIDS is a revealer of problems. I also think that the AIDS response is a revealer of solutions. How we've responded to the AIDS pandemic has shown the strength of our activist voice. And our activist voice includes healthcare professionals. I'm also a nurse. I've worked in HIV for many years, both domestically in my own country and throughout Africa. And I do think that by empowering the voices of health workers and allowing them to first understand the situation, be part of the solution at the table with the activists, is part of the way to effectively respond to this question. One of the quotes that Roger England had in his article was the exceptionalism of HIV or AIDS. And he said, isn't the death of millions of young children from pneumonia an exceptional situation? Isn't maternal mortality rates an exceptional situation? My answer is yes, these are all exceptional and need to be responded to in exceptional manners. And I think this is where we can bring our expertise to the table. And the exceptional should be the norm. It should be standard. Our response that we've learned, the lessons learned here are invaluable. And, you know, once again, it is a major issue of funding, limited resources. So let's not look to take away from AIDS. Let's use the lessons learned, add to the overall resource pool, bring the activists to the table, allow them to address the global fund. We're having round 9 is coming up. Let's look at the voices of the learned and say, let's start encouraging countries to invest in health system strengthening. Part of this initiative is a civil society-led initiative, advocacy initiative, and it is internationally, our membership is internationally renowned. And we are actually looking at funding issues and that is not about HIV specific. Although when you look at the table, most of us are there because of our work in HIV. So I urge each one of you to learn more about the initiative and join us in our voice and our common response to this situation.
Jacqueline, but from the International AIDS, it's very exciting that your governing council identified human resources as a major issue. And how do you see this going forward? You're talking about working in partnership. What would you like to see come out of this particular session and this this particular meeting at AIDS? What would you like to see us do to take real action on the problem of HIV or the relationship between HIV and human resources?
Thank you, Jim. I'll start with an anecdote from my own experience as working at the district as a district health medical officer, and also when I just graduated from Makerere University. At that time, I was earning $50 US, and most of per month, regardless of the hours I worked and the workload. And most of my friends at the time were looking to leave the country to find better pay, better working conditions, and I think the situation as described in the Global Health Workforce Alliance. And at the district, we accepted the situation the way it was, weak health systems and the challenges of shortages of health workforce. We didn't question that perhaps there could be a different scenario. And then HIV came along, and it changed the dynamics completely. If I was a district medical officer again, I would not accept to go to health facilities that have drug cupboards that are empty, that have nobody working there, that have patients that cannot say anything. I would not accept that. And I thank HIV for that. The International AIDS Society a few years ago started to discuss the expansion of the discussion around HIV to better integrate a public health agenda. And as Craig said, this is something we'd like to see more and more of, so that HIV is discussed in the context of the lives in which people, of the realities on the ground. Just like Pat said, a woman might be HIV positive, but also be pregnant, looking after children. So we'd like to see more and more of this coming through country presentations, coming through the research, and placing HIV within that reality. But the exceptionalism has to continue, as Pat said, also reflecting all these challenges as they come. The second is that I think this discussion has gained momentum simply because of treatment. But when people were dying and there was no treatment, I didn't hear these people speak up. And I think that we need to challenge them on that. The pre-treatment and the post-treatment has changed this discussion that we need to take note of. But I think that more and more, some of us are scholars of the distinguished panel here, HIV has even started to go beyond simply saying how is scale-up happening, to look more at social health protection. And we hope within this conference and subsequent conferences, we can start to ask, are the most vulnerable people accessing health services and how are they able to pay? Are they actually getting to pay out of pocket and finding themselves even more impoverished? So all the aspects of the health system, all the six components as WHO would have described them, we would like to see more of that research and discussion happening. So we hope that this is the first of many debates where HIV is at the center, but this continuously looks at the dynamics of human resource, at financing, at infrastructure, and at lab services, everything. Because for HIV, for us to achieve universal access goals, all these other aspects also have to be working well. And we know as patients or people living with HIV, we will not stop unless we have access not only to ARVs, but to other aspects of our healthcare. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Tessa, you represent the International Council of Nurses, but also you're here representing the World Health Professions Association, doctors, nurses, pharmacists. What are some of the ways that you see we can begin to solve this problem of human resources? Minister Tedros mentioned some of the ways that they've been doing it in Ethiopia. But there are a lot of issues on the table, task shifting. What are you doing in these organizations to try to help support the needs for more health workers in countries?
Thank you very much, Jim. I also feel the argument of attempting to divide the issue into vertical, horizontal, I think is very artificial. I think this will divert us from the main issues of optimizing the performance of health systems, optimizing the production of healthcare workers. And so whether we opt for a vertical system or a horizontal system, they all require human resources. And at the moment, we face a crisis, a double crisis, I would say. We have the crisis of numbers, a shortage of doctors, a shortage of nurses, a shortage of, if you like, everyone else. We also face the other crisis of morale, the other crisis of motivation, the other crisis of willing to stay in our own countries. And so these are the burning issues, I think, that we should address. Because if we have adequate numbers, if we have competent health professionals at home where they are needed, it doesn't matter if we have vertical or horizontal problems, programs, I think we'll be able to staff them. Perhaps vertical programs are an admission of failure, perhaps. Perhaps people are going vertical because they feel that's a low-hanging fruit, perhaps. And so, like my colleague, like Craig was saying, I think a sensible way to go is a comprehensive primary healthcare approach rather than a fragmented approach. And so what are the health profession doing? Obviously, the health professions are deeply concerned by the current crisis, crisis in numbers and crisis in the morale and motivation of the health workforce. Many of us health professionals here would agree that if you ask the young person who is going into medical school, into a nursing school, and ask them, why do you want to be a doctor? Why do you want to be a dentist, a nurse? They will tell you they are out to save the world. The same person, the very person, you know, if you ask him the same question, 6-7 years down the road, has become a burned out, a demotivated human being. Why is that? I think part of it is the health system that's more or less dysfunctional. I think part of it is health policies that are not supportive of the health workforce. And so in moving forward, I would echo what the Honorable Minister, Minister Tedros, was saying. We need to train in adequate numbers. I know sometimes that can be an issue because that can be a deep pit that never fills. But I think if we train adequate numbers in all countries, in developing and developed, by the way, because if the developed countries have adequately trained health workers, there is no room for poaching. There is no room for the pull-push factors that are pushing and pulling healthcare workers from their countries. And so we need to train in adequate numbers. And here, what are the health professionals doing? We are lobbying, we are advocating the governments, advocating international organizations, but we are also working in partnership with the Global Alliance, for example, to address human resources issues. For example, the International Council of Nurses has established what we call International Center for Human Resources in Nursing, which is really documenting the movement of nurses, the availability of nurses, the issues that are affecting quality of care delivery, and sharing this information with governments in an online way, sharing this information with governments and with others. Many of our colleagues in the other professions are doing the same. But I must admit, it's a very serious issue, and I think we shouldn't be deflected
from this issue by artificial discussions of vertical, horizontal, and so on. Thank you.
So thank you very much, Tesfa. Seeing that we have very little disagreement on this topic, let's move on to something that maybe we can find some disagreement on. Anandi, tell us about the experience of stigma again, and tell us what it's been like to try to get services. Go ahead.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. This, you know, my memory around the stigma that I experienced is still fresh in my mind. It's, you know, I want you to take way back to 10 years when I was diagnosed HIV positive in 1998. And then I didn't disclose my HIV status. I was comfortable with my status. And then, you know, I didn't have any problem. But then I was, I got an opportunity to work with an NGO, and then finally I thought that this is where I need to work because I'm HIV positive, and I see many of my fellow people in the HIV have been experiencing, they have been stigmatized and, you know, discriminated, and I felt that need to work in the field, and then I updated my skills on counseling. I became counselor in one of the medical colleges. So that's where the story is going to start. Just I'll be very brief. And then I joined as a counselor, but I didn't disclose my HIV status within the medical college where I was working as a counselor. And I had to go for my dental scaling, and one of my doctor who knew my status, HIV status, told me that he is still treating people in the HIV and he is taking care of. He told me, okay, go to the so-and-so doctor dentist, but don't reveal your HIV status because, you know, he may send you back and he will not treat you. You know, we haven't referred anyone for, you know, dental problems. So I was confused because I was very new within the health system, within the medical college. So I thought I was confused. I went and then, you know, I spoke to this dentist. And I introduced myself. My doctor already informed the dentist that the counselor from the HIV AIDS clinic is coming for some treatment. And then I told, I asked him, introduced myself that I'm a counselor and I'm a recent recruit, and an NGO has, recruited me within the thanks for the vertical programs that, so I got this opportunity. So I said, I'm the HIV AIDS counselor, and he was happy to, he said, okay, what's your problem? What is it that you want? I said, I have my dental, this thing, and I was curious, and I wanted to check, basically, really challenge why he is not treating, and I was like, because I wanted to confront the situation, how I would be treated if I might disclose my HIV status. So I took that opportunity. I thought, okay, I asked him, like, have you treated HIV positive people? And no, I haven't come across anyone. And are you using the universal precautions for everyone? No, I don't use the universal precaution. I don't use gloves. And then you assume that everyone is not positive, and then you keep, you're giving the treatment. What if somebody comes and, tells you that they are HIV positive, and will you treat? And he was confused. He didn't know how to address that question, how to really. I said, then, if you use gloves and you will not be infected, you will not have that risk of exposure to HIV. Yes, he nodded his head, and then, I said, will you treat me? Yeah, I said, I'm HIV positive. Will you use gloves and treat my, problem? He was really taken aback and he didn't know what to do, but he admired the way I challenged him and I was talking to him. I was engaged him in the dialogue. So he said, yes. And then, but give me one day. And you come tomorrow, I'll treat you. I did go, but eventually he treated me. And that's when he said, the first time I have treated HIV positive and demanded, and, using the universal precaution, the gloves. And, he was so thrilled also, like, I must say, he was so happy. But then what I'm saying is, like, that was the thing. And I also, at the same time, at the, you know, 10 years back, and one of my colleagues who was a nurse, her husband got admitted at the hospital, and they later on they diagnosed him as HIV positive. And eventually, you know, they went to her, and the medical college asked her to go for HIV test, mandatory. And she was also HIV positive. She was diagnosed HIV positively. Immediately, they removed her from the main healthcare. This thing, they put her in a, you know, an isolation ward where they are taking care of people in the HIV. So she was asked to take care of all the people in the HIV, and she was not included into the main team. So that's the kind of experience that it was 10 years back. But situation, if you ask me whether it has changed, it has not really changed even now. Because what I'm saying is, when I moved to Delhi to work, and one of my colleagues who works with the Positive Network, she went to a super, super specialty hospital in Delhi. And, how much government money has been invested in super, super specialty hospital. And she went for her TB treatment. And she was asked to stand in the queue. She was asked every time her term comes, and she was asked to go back and stand in the queue. And when she asked, like, okay, we'll wait, we'll come to you until we have finished everybody, and we'll come to you. And then the doctor and the paramedics, they took care of everybody else. And then, like, when her term, came, she asked why she was asked to stand so long, and why she was waiting, and why they made her to wait. And they said, we know that you are HIV positive, and, we can now use gloves, and we can treat you. So that's the kind of, the situation even now. That's right. I just want to...
Let me go to Sigrun for a second. Sigrun probably has visited more HIV programs than anyone. And let me ask you this. We've committed to universal access. How are we going to ever get there? Tell us about what you've seen and what we need to do about stigma if we have to any hope at all of reaching universal access.
That was a hard trigger question. But if I first could say... Is this stigma affecting healthcare in Norway? Because I've also visited in Norway. I know a lot of my HIV-positive friends in Norway experience similar things. In Norway, where it's not a matter of throwing money at the system, where it's not a matter of lack of health workers, but it's a lack of knowledge. It's, not being familiar, but also somehow being scared and facing up. And I think that some of the countries... with a heavy load, where this is something that we gradually get to know how to address. Some of those are examples of how one can change attitudes within health systems. And I think that we have a lot to learn also from south to north when it comes to stigma. It's global. I wish that health workers... associations, training institutions would really start to address what are the root causes there, because I do think that stigma is a major barrier to universal access. And if it is so that health workers are burned out and demotivated, if it is so that treating HIV is down on the list, if it's so that chronic diseases and having patients in a separate part of an institution means that health workers do not, be part of the bigger system, then we need to address it. And I think throwing money at health systems, yes, I'm sitting in the Global Fund. I'm part of a government where we both fund national systems like we heard about earlier, wanting governments to set priorities and so on, but we also fund the Global Fund. And we think that we have to work, pull these forces together and actually use that energy that's there in some of the movements for AIDS, because bureaucracies are not in movement. Bureaucracies may get money, they can account for money, but it's stuck there, it doesn't come out. So that urge of making results and bringing in the various stakeholders is what can create universal access. Mm. I don't dare to come with special examples, but that's my passion. Thank you.
Greg, you are involved with lots of different organizations of people living with HIV/AIDS. Can you give us some examples of what you've been hearing out there in the field?
Well, let's not talk about HIV stigma. Let's talk about drug users in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. You know, healthcare providers, and it's not just healthcare providers, it's NGO workers like me and Anandi and other people in this audience, have utter disdain for drug users and contempt for them. We'll talk about them behind their backs. And, you know, I'm sure I do a lot of work with drug users, but I'm sure it's the same for sex workers and gay men. And so both for anybody who's working in the healthcare profession, whether it's medical professionals, nurses, health officers, counselors, NGO workers, I think it's not just about HIV stigma. It's about drug use, sex, and other things that are going to drive people away from the healthcare system and leave them left behind from in universal access. And so, I mean, it's part of talking about health system strengthening. I think we have to confront those issues of stigma, not just about HIV, but about drug use, sex workers, men who have sex with men, and do it in a really concerted way.
Pat, is it just about discrimination against people living with HIV who are trying to get services? What about within the health professions?
I think as we sit here and talk about the need to increase the numbers of healthcare workers and standardize training, and as we try to scale up health workers in many, many countries, part of the challenge will be to integrate into this curriculum, particularly in pre-service, health as a human right, a rights-based approach, so that all have equal access to health care. So it's not just about HIV, and it's not just disease-specific, but and it's not just about the most marginalized, but equal access across the board. And if healthcare workers have the opportunity to learn, become desensitized to the fact that many of the discriminatory feelings that healthcare workers hold, they're not even aware. A values clarification session within one classroom can show you how divided a healthcare worker group can be. So I think we have a challenge in front of us. So when we're going to scale up and over the next few years increase our healthcare workforce by 2.6 million to meet the 4 million deficit, we've got to look at the curriculum, look at the training. So I challenge the countries, all of our countries, including my own, to really look at healthcare as a human right within the healthcare profession itself. And then I think we might be able to begin to address this issue.
Dr. Frank, how have you been dealing, how did you deal with the problem of stigma here in Mexico?
Well, I believe when it comes to the relationship with the health workforce, that you know, people are motivated by what one could say are three I's. Information. A lot of what we're calling stigma is fear. From health workers that are actually disinformed about modes of transmission or are actually not provided with the necessary tools to reduce their own risk and to fulfill their mandate, their ethical obligation. The second is incentives. We need to change the way we hire and promote and remunerate health workers so that they become responsive to the needs of patients, not just HIV patients, but in general. And part of this reform I was talking about did involve new incentives for achieving targets of treatment and other incentives to healthcare workers so that we may solve some of the structural problems of poorly remunerated and poorly motivated health workers who don't see any advance, even if they perform in a very positive way. And the third I is internalized values. And I think mostly through the educational system, I fully agree, internalizing the values that are embedded in our codes of ethics. But if you just think that last I and changing people's head is going to transform reality, I think that's not it. We need to also work on the other I's and solve the systemic issues that sometimes constrain the best performance that a health worker could achieve. I think those are some ideas, and of course there's lots of examples from around the world that we need to disseminate through best practice.
Great. Honorable Minister, let me ask you, you have been more serious, or at least as serious as anyone in Africa,
about reaching universal access. But not only do we have problems of stigma against people in the community trying to receive services, but there's stigma within the health workforce. Health workers who have HIV feel especially stigmatized, and we've heard horror stories. How are you going to reach universal access how are you going to work through the problem of stigma on your way to reaching universal access?
Thank you very much, Jim. I think in our case, what we're trying to do is it's through education, actually. Our communities, our whole health workers, to actually address the problem. And we're using all means or outlets to educate our communities and health workers. And the other issue is, I think we're...
A little closer.
We're partly responsible for the stigma, the health sector itself. Because in hospitals, we tend to have like ART clinics. And we treat HIV like a different health problem. But it's like any other illness. We have to recognize that. And what we're doing now is we're making all our health institutions process-based. Like we have inpatient services, outpatient services, emergency services, and then any patient, it could be HIV or it could be TB, malaria, or any other illness, goes through these processes as any like any other health problem, and we're actually abandoning the issue of this ART clinic and so on. We have just started it, and we're using the business process reengineering to have this model implemented in our hospitals. I think it has been successful in some countries. And through that process, actually, we're cutting even waiting time of patients. Because from triage center, where they do the initial checkup, you know, medical records, you know, the pain and so on, and then they move straight to case teams where they have the examination, some of minor procedures and so on, almost all taken care of through the pharmacy, then they're out. They stop just in three places and cut by several, like more than 60 percent actually of waiting time. So I think we have to see it as health system, one system in general, and trying to address it within that. Then we can reduce stigma because we have admitted actually we're the source of stigma. Mm. Thank you.
Tesfa, so you represent doctors, dentists, nurses, and pharmacists. In some senses, we could say that the people you represent are the source of the problem. So we've heard about educational initiatives, structural initiatives. What can those health professions organizations do to really make an attempt at reducing stigma?
Thank you, Jim. I think one of the challenges is the health system itself. We have health systems that are dysfunctional in a way. And at the end of the day, health workers are people like the rest of us. And so they see that health systems do not care about them. You have an elegantly trained professional, and he or she is put in an inelegant, in a terrible situation. Some of you have seen, all of you have seen, the working conditions of many of the health professionals. There is no excuse to stigma, by the way. There is no excuse at all. But we know the health system itself and the current stigma in the health system itself is contributing or perpetuating the stigma itself. Because healthcare workers are asking themselves, if I get the HIV, if I am the next person in that bed, then I am going to receive all that stigma that I see. And so that fear, I think, is perpetuating this stigma. There has been lots of talk about stigma, but little action. And we believe, the health professions believe, it's time to act. The big challenges are, how could we make health professionals become the trendsetters? How could we create health systems that are stigma-free or that are friendly to people living with HIV/AIDS? I think we need to start by engaging in a dialogue, in a campaign, sustained campaign with people who are living with HIV/AIDS. we need to engage that group, I think. Just as that group has been able to mobilize resources and energy towards HIV prevention and care, I think we could mobilize that resources also working with the health professions and the people living with HIV/AIDS and the activists towards creating health systems that are stigma-free. I think most of all we need to create positive environments for healthcare workers, because we have settings at the moment where the average health worker doesn't get a glove, where the average midwife is delivering babies bare hands. And don't tell me that midwife shouldn't be afraid, or don't tell me that midwife shouldn't protect, that nurse shouldn't protect herself. It's just a normal human instinct, despite all the ethics, despite all the commitment and the compassion to care. And so, while there is no excuse to perpetuating stigma in health systems, we believe that the healthcare workers are also facing a daunting challenge in that they are not supported. One activity that the healthcare workers have taken seriously, the healthcare profession associations have taken seriously, is what we call positive practice environment, working with the Global Health Workforce Alliance, the WHPA, the World Health Professions Alliance, and others. We are working towards improving the environment in which health workers are working. In this way, we hope to optimize their performance, to retain them, to recruit others who are probably migrating into other professions or migrating into other countries. And so care of the care provider, the classical analogy, metaphor that comes is we have all flown to come here from wherever we live, and the hostess, the cabin crew, always tell us to put the mask in ourselves before helping others. I think we need to embrace that kind of analogy in health systems if we are going to combat stigma and discrimination. Otherwise, we are going to talk and perpetuate stigma. And care of the carer, that person, that nurse, that physician, that dentist who is working day and night, when he or she gets HIV, often stands on the same line, on the same queue as the patients that he or she serves. I mean, how unfair could the health systems be? And many health workers are telling us, if the system doesn't care, why should I? And this is typically a sign of burned out health professionals. And burning out, I think, is not an intentional effort that we bring on ourselves. I think it's systems that burn us out. It's health systems. And so we need to strengthen health systems. We need to create positive practice environments. We need to care for the carers as a matter of priority. For example, access to ARV, access to counseling, access to testing. We need to provide protective equipment, gloves, and others. But equally important, we need to engage with people who are living with HIV/AIDS and learn from them. What are we doing wrong? We also need to exchange best practices. What works? And I think that's why I was saying there is much talk but little action, little data. We need to share this data. What works, let's say, in fighting stigma? My colleague here was saying, Pat was saying, value clarification. The ICN is working in this area, training nurses in many places. We know there is a short-term effect, for example, but we don't have evidence if it has a sustained long-term effect. We need that evidence. We need to invest in combating HIV, just in combating stigma, just as we have to combat HIV/AIDS. Thank you.
Thank you. And, you know, this is a just extraordinary panel. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. So I'd like to invite the Deputy Director General, Madame Ndiaye Ndioro, to make a brief comment on representing the International Organization of Migration.
you, madam. I would like to congratulate all the panelists, but I would like also to contribute a little bit on this debate. Because today we are effectively facing some competing priorities. And the most critical priority that the African countries in particular, the developing countries in general, is facing is the one of the shortage of human resources to make the health system work and to make some development, because we will have obviously healthy people to lead our development process. Now, IOM, because I work with IOM since 10 years, after having been the director, Minister of Development Social in my country during 10 years, I know that this brain drain of person that IOM is asking for taking into account in the at the policy level is something very, very important. As far as we will not provide some solution, some answer to the going out of all these people by developing our own policies in our country, it will be more and more dramatic. Now, we are looking at additional resources, and additional human resources for the health system might be health workers outside their countries. All the diaspora in outside Africa want to help to develop a more sustainable, a more normal health system, like this gentleman talked about later on, before me. I would like to say that the African diaspora health workers would like to intervene in their own country of origin. And the problem we are facing is a problem of policy. How can we reform our policy in the countries of origin that can integrate those health workforce that are outside and that want to come in and contribute to the development of this country? This is the contribution we would like to bring in this debate. How can we scale up the health system of our country by bringing in the competences, the expertise of diaspora health workers living abroad? They want it. It is possible, but as far as we do not reform our national health system to integrate them, to have a multi-sectorial approach to deliver a service of health, we will, of course, face this kind of shortage. This is what we would like to share with you, and please take into account in your delivery and in your delivery statement or in your conclusion this kind of additional forces that we can bring in the human resource task force we have to undertake in our countries. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll only have time for two questions. The first is we'll ask Miriam Ware. Is Miriam in the audience somewhere? Yes, right here. Yes.
Thank you very much, sir. And thank you very much to the panel. You have really kept us awake. And so my question is, can we request the countries, the 57 countries, especially the 57 countries which have got a human resource crisis, to report at the next meeting at least one district in their country which has put into practice all the good ideas that we are hearing, so that we don't come back and just talk in generalities. I think my brother from Ethiopia will have done the whole country by then. But can all the other sluggards at least have at least one country, at least one district, so that we make it a requirement? That's my...
Let me ask Jacqueline to comment on that first, and anyone else would like to.
Thank you very much. I think that's a fantastic proposal. I'm sure there are members attending this conference who would agree that have been pushing for greater accountability from countries. And I think this is where, to add to what you've said, I'd like to add a couple of eyes to what Honorable Julio Frank mentioned before, and that is on the information. Many times we read about healthcare workers that are affected, about 20% may have been lost due to AIDS in some countries. A study from South Africa where there was comparable rates, prevalence rates, and then it kind of goes quiet. So I think we'd like to see this becoming more integral to how we look at this issue as part of being able to develop effective interconnected solutions. The other I'd like to add is just to underscore the issue of infection control, because as a competing priority, we've got other issues like TB, where TB HIV becomes integrated and also becomes a source of fear. But there are other issues that come in and then affect this issue profoundly. And I hope that we can add infection control as to one of the priorities that we have to address in the response going forward. And then a couple of final points. One is that of empowerment. We have learned in this movement that you have to empower the most affected communities. And I think for healthcare workers, one of the forms of empowerment will be better understanding how to manage their own health. The assumption is they're healthcare workers, so they know how HIV is treated, and I think that's a wrong assumption. Yes, the clinical researchers and the AIDS experts may know, but while others may be involved in delivering care, they may not have even the knowledge that Greg has, all the complexities of first line, second line, when to start, when to switch, that some people in the PLHIV movement have acquired over the years. You'd think they've got PhDs and or professors of medicine. So I think we need to extend this to healthcare workers and make sure that they are also empowered. And I think that will come to deal with stigma over time. And then finally, to encourage that we take this message perhaps through the alliance and through the partnership and call on countries that are making progress to work with the normative agencies to really document their experience and conduct strong analysis, and perhaps we see this more and more coming through the next international AIDS conferences. Thank you.
So while we ask Freddie Perez to come up, Miriam, here's how I hear that. So at the next meeting, representatives of all 57 countries that have a human resources crisis will be invited to come. And there will be a special, and the IAS will pay for their transport completely. And they'll be invited to come not just to present, but to talk about what they've done and then begin to share, just like we've talked, that let's turn IAS into a place where at least once every 2 years we come and compare notes, teach each other, and then leave the conference linked together in our efforts to solve the problem of human resources. So thank you very much for that commitment. We'll find the representatives. Let's turn this meeting into a working meeting where people actually compare notes and share notes in a way that will be helpful back home. Is Dr. Freddie Perez? No. Okay. George, let me just say a couple quick things. Mark Dybul has sent his apologies. He very much wanted to be here with us. Logistics prevented him from doing it. And we would now like Sir George Alain to wrap this all up and explain to us what we need to do to go forward. Thank you.
Thanks very much. This has been fascinating to me, sitting as a non-consular bystander. When the proposal was put to me that I should make a summary at the end of this meeting, it seemed to me that there were two kinds of issues. And one of the problems is how you bring these two issues together. And I have to confess from the beginning that I start as a confessed optimist. I am a confessed optimist. And what I want to start with is the idea that we should all be clear that there has been tremendous progress. Of course we could do better, but as Peter said, there has been tremendous progress. When we think of what the situation was like in Vancouver, and when we come to now, there has been tremendous progress. And let us recognize that. And that progress would not have been possible unless there had been health systems functioning. They have not functioned ideally, but they have functioned. This is not to say that we must be complacent, hubristic, and not do anything. But let us recognize it is unfair to the millions of healthcare workers out there to give the impression that nothing has happened. There has been progress. And if you agree, there seems to be general agreement, as Jim was saying, that this debate is a sterile one. And we ask, why does a sterile debate continue? I used to work for a gentleman who used to say that we in health have the tendency to be arrested at the level of binary thought. It's either or. We can never see that the light, that world is not like that. Things have to exist together. And another one is an old English tune that says, the devil always has the sweetest tunes. I'm not calling Roger England a devil, so don't say that. The devil always has the sweetest tunes. And if you look at what has allowed this debate to continue, is the good thing that there has been increased funding available for this problem. Not enough. Agreed. But there has been increased funding available for this. And not that money is the root of evil, but the problem is that we face how to use this money more effectively. That is the root of the issue. How do we use the increased resources available to use it more effectively? How we use the exceptionalism, I'm not sure which word is correct, of AIDS more appropriately. And I think of today, it would be irresponsible of us not to take advantage of the exceptionality of AIDS for the purposes that Jim has set out initially. And the Global Health Workforce Allowance, I'm pleased to see some of my colleagues here from the Alliance, has sought to address this problem, I think, in a very logical way. And if I may sum up what they have said, is that there is a clear need throughout all 190 countries for more resources. And all countries should be self-sufficient. The old idea that there were source and destination countries is passé. Many of the big countries are source countries. At the same time, they are recipient countries. And what I would like to see is our acceptance of that is a global problem. And we are not going to reach the day yet, not in my lifetime, the utopia, when there are enough human resources. But let us accept the thesis that the Alliance puts forward, that the basic approach is one of numbers, distribution, and disposition. And that day, until the utopia comes, where we have enough, let us agree with the workforce that we have to deal with things like ethical recruitment, a convention for ethical recruitment of workforces. And I would like to pose two questions, or two theses for this part of the discussion. One, that all of us go from this place singing, we will never allow anyone to sing that tune in our presence again. We will never allow people to try to put it in the sense of a dichotomy, resource and AIDS. We must never do that. And the second thing I would ask, that we approve and applaud the activism around AIDS, and we should have that activism around AIDS have it embrace what the Global Workforce Allowance is trying to do. It is possible. I am convinced with the kind of activism we have seen and result of activism to have movement in terms of the workforce that is necessary for the appropriate treatment of all the world's diseases, including AIDS. Now, HIV has, I believe, unleashed a level of activism that I have never seen in my lifetime before. And I think that it would be irresponsible of us not to engage that community in other issues like these. And I think that many of us, many people have a false impression of unique self-interest in terms of the AIDS activism. I believe that is not true. And I would like to see this activism embracing the sort of issues I mentioned before. The second issue that was addressed is the issue of stigma and discrimination. And I would like to address this in the context of what was said in terms of the progress. We've made progression where we have seen advances in terms of treatment. We know there's an angst about prevention, tremendous angst about prevention, tremendous angst about universal access to prevention. And the extent to which stigma and discrimination impedes that universal access to prevention. And if we agree that the universal access to prevention is going to involve workers that are not traditionally counted as health workers, and I agree with Greg that those persons, when they become involved with HIV, they are going to be stigmatized, the point he makes. So we are going to see an expanding pool of stigmatized persons. Because, in one sense, because of our attention to universal access to prevention. And there are reams written about stigma, and we can't go into it here, but as Julio says, it is both stigma and fear. And the aspect of fear is, in a sense, correctable. The aspect of stigma is more basic and more difficult to correct. But I believe that it is possible to address the epidemic of stigma. And I believe that it is possible to address it, and it's been said by many in the panel, by addressing the individual who stigmatizes others, and then address the enabling environment which facilitates that those individuals exercise in stigma and discrimination. And my heart warmed to the idea of not making AIDS illness a special case, that making AIDS another one of the problems of the infectious diseases. And why I say this, in my lifetime I have lived to see mental health, psychiatric illness incorporated into general practice and leave a lot of the stigma behind because it was incorporated general practice. So I laud the idea of incorporating AIDS into the kind of general treatment that you mentioned. I am concerned, and it was expressed here, that not only this expanded pool of health workers may stigmatize, but they themselves may be stigmatized. And we have to look at if these represent the frontline workers in our addressing the AIDS population, can we afford them to be disengaged and not optimally effective because they are destigmatized? Because those persons who are stigmatized are not optimally effective. Can we allow that? And the answer categorically is no. And we've heard some concrete suggestions and how we might do that. And I like the idea of education within the health professions themselves. The evidence is that education to young school children can reduce their possibility of stigmatizing others. And I'd like to urge my colleagues from the health professions to be actively engaged in promoting the idea that education within these professions can encourage them not to stigmatize others and to value themselves to the extent that they don't stigmatize one another. But it's not only internally that I think we should address this, and this is not coming to discussion, but I would introduce it. Legislation. Don't let us omit legislation as a possibility of reducing stigma discrimination among categories of workers. I know that there are places where the labor laws still allow for discrimination against health workers. This is changeable. This is modifiable. And I like the idea of the positive practice environment. I would not like to give the idea that I leave here because I'm an optimist, that I believe everything is rosy and nothing more has to be done. There's a tremendous task that needs to be done. But one of my favorite Negro spirituals says, "Dear Lord, don't move away the mountain. Just give me the strength to climb." Thank you.
Thank you very much, everybody.